From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR Sports Show, Only a Game. The Orioles returned to Camden Yards after protests and riots in Baltimore marked the first time fans were not allowed into a Major League ballgame, and it was very, very quiet. Ahead on Only a Game, we'll hear from Tim Kirchen. He was there. Also, how David Blatt overcame a lack of NBA experience and hot flying objects on his way to becoming the Cleveland Cavaliers head coach, and a new documentary explores how free play has contributed to human development. Also coming up, why this weekend's Pacquiao-Mayweather fight won't revive the dying sport of boxing, and an English professor trades his tweed jacket for a brief MMA career and writes about it.
What I'm working through in the book is my own ambivalence toward fighting. What's wrong with me, and what's wrong with so many of us who are drawn to this kind of violent entertainment?
Stay tuned.
So quiet at the ballpark that I'm afraid that I might be speaking too loudly.
That's Orioles radio play-by-play announcer Joe Angel on Baltimore's 105.7 The Fan, calling Wednesday afternoon's game at Camden Yards between the Orioles and the Chicago White Sox. There was no noise in the stands because there were no fans sitting in them. Protests and riots in Baltimore over the death of Freddie Gray led Major League Baseball to postpone games that had been scheduled for Monday and Tuesday night. The league then decided fans would not be allowed into Wednesday's game at Camden Yards, and for the first time in history, a ball game was played in an empty stadium. ESPN's Tim Kirchen was there. Tim, what did it feel like to be there on Wednesday afternoon?
Bill, it was just about as strange as you can imagine, and it really took flight in the first inning when Chris Davis hit a monster home run to right field, and there was virtual silence as he hit it and then rounded the bases. The only thing we could hear was Gary Thorne, the play-by-play guy for the Orioles, doing his signature home run call, goodbye home run. You could hear it all over the ballpark.
Oh, my gosh.
Which never happens on a home run. It was the eeriest thing I've seen in a long time. Now, we did hear some fans who were across the street. They'd spent $300 for hotel rooms at the Hilton that overlooks the ballpark, and they gave it an O-R-I-O-L-E-S chant after that. It was so far away you could barely hear it, but in the stadium you could hear virtually everything, which is what made it such an interesting afternoon.
Here's Orioles center fielder Adam Jones talking about playing again after having the first two games of the series postponed.
It's always good to get back on the field of familiar places. It's our escape from reality. That's why, you know, the fans need to be here, because it's the escape from reality.
Tim, did you feel that being at Camden Yards on Wednesday was an escape from reality?
Well, it certainly was an escape from what was going on in Baltimore. And all kidding aside, Bill, it was so bad there that this was the only thing the Orioles could do. With the curfew the way it was at 10 p.m., they couldn't play a night game. The White Sox weren't coming back this year scheduled to, so if they had postponed three games, it would have been virtually impossible to make up all three. So this was an escape from the fires and the looting and the rioting in Baltimore, and I think it was much needed for the city, much needed for the Orioles, much needed for a lot of people.
Tim, you're a Maryland guy. You've spent a lot of time in Baltimore over the years. What have you seen and heard this week outside the ballpark?
Well, I have gotten countless messages from people, some of whom I know well and some I don't know so well, who think I live in downtown Baltimore, which I don't. But it was a bunch of, please be careful there, because nationally, all you see is this horrendous violence. And I can tell you, Bill, at the stadium, you're about 15 blocks away. When I arrived there on the day of the game, I saw no police presence, no extra security. It seemed like another day, which I took as a positive thing. I know Peter Angelos, the owner, had revenue on his mind, not for one second during any of this. And they felt, with Major League Baseball's help, the best way to keep everyone safe was to lock the doors and don't put anyone in harm's way in case somebody decided to come do something at the stadium.
Tim, I wonder if being there on Wednesday had you thinking about other moments in history when baseball changed its plans because of social unrest.
Well, it did, of course, Bill. You know, there was the Rodney King situation in L.A. a long time ago, and Dan Duquette was the GM of the Expos at that time, and now he's the GM of the Orioles. So they were headed to the ballpark that day to play and were just told, turn around, send your team back, go on home. And then they canceled all three games of that series. And when the Expos went back to L.A., their only other trip to L.A., they had to play three straight doubleheaders because there was no other choice. So, yes, this reminded me of that. And in the end, I think the right thing was done. It's a debatable point, but I don't think baseball had much of a choice here. And then, of course, they moved these games to Tampa Bay for the weekend instead of playing them in Baltimore, another attempt to keep people as safe as possible in Baltimore.
Tim Kirkjian is one of the few people who can tell his grandchildren that he saw in person the Orioles play the White Sox on April 29th, 2015. Tim, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
The Cavalier quest of LeBron James to bring a championship to Cleveland continues on Monday when the Cavs host the Chicago Bulls in Game 1 of their second-round playoff series. James is making his 10th consecutive postseason appearance, but Cleveland's head coach is new to that neighborhood. Though he has dodged flying objects while coaching overseas, David Blatt never played in the NBA, and before this season he'd never coached in the league, not even as an assistant. Only a game's Martin Kessler and Doug Trabue have the story of Blatt's very long path to the NBA.
You know, Doug, technically David Blatt's been to the NBA playoffs before.
Just remember it was really big and really loud, and I was at the top of the stadium.
That's right, Martin, but that was back in the 1960s in the old Boston Garden.
I saw Sam Jones hit a shot, front rim, back rim, in the basket against the Lakers in the finals, one of the most unbelievable shots I ever saw. I think I was 8 or 9 years, or maybe I was 9 or 10 years old.
Blatt grew up in Massachusetts, and back then he was cheering on the Celtics.
And on Thursday, in his homecoming at the new Boston Garden, the fans didn't exactly welcome him back.
Blatt's hometown of Framingham is just 20 miles outside of Boston. But his coaching journey began 5,468 miles away in northern Israel.
Former University of Miami star Jake Morton played for David Blatt at that first coaching stop, and the team was called Hapoel Galil Elyon.
You got close with guys because there was nothing to do up there. It was like up in the Golan Heights on the border of Lebanon.
After one really late night, Blatt and Morton, two Americans far from home, started talking about their dreams.
And I remember him saying, he's like, you know, one day I want to have an opportunity to coach in the NBA. And at the time, I couldn't fathom that to even be realistic. I think at the time it wasn't done. So when he used to talk about it, I was like, oh, okay, that's wishful thinking. That's dreaming for the stars.
That big dream hadn't occurred to Blatt when he was growing up.
You know, Doug, he says coaching hadn't even crossed his mind when he was playing college basketball at Princeton.
But other people saw a coach in the making.
He was a very intense sort of guy and a very physical presence.
That's Joseph Mackin. In the late 70s, he attended a basketball camp run by Princeton's players.
One of these camps for middle schoolers and high schoolers.
And one of the staff members was David Blatt.
We played hard, and he was very demanding, and Blatt seemed to be in charge.
Blatt wasn't in charge. He was still in college.
After graduating from Princeton, Blatt played professionally in Israel off and on for more than a decade. But when an injury ended his career, he took a job as an assistant for Hapoel Galil Elyon.
Eventually, Blatt became head coach of Maccabi Tel Aviv. That team plays in the EuroLeague, and it's essentially the Showtime of Israel.
It would be like, you know, the Lakers or playing for the Celtics. That's how I kind of compare it.
That's Derek Sharp, an American who played for Maccabi for 15 seasons.
And then you got the entire country, you know, behind you, and especially when you're playing in Europe. It's definitely something totally different. I mean, I don't know any other place like it.
Blatt succeeded with Maccabi, and he put roots down. His family still lives in Israel.
He also landed the head coaching job for the Russian national team, and in 2014, he led Maccabi to the EuroLeague title.
That's when Cleveland came calling, and that move raised questions like this one on ESPN.
Blatt's been coaching and playing in Europe for his entire professional career. He's never coached in the States, so what do the Cavs see in this guy?
The spotlight became brighter when less than a month after Blatt's hiring, four-time MVP LeBron James announced his return to Cleveland.
The Cavs also traded for star forward Kevin Love, giving Blatt a superstar lineup, and Cleveland was a preseason pick to win the NBA title.
Then the Cavs got off to a slow start, and that brought more questions about Blatt's hiring and his relationship with LeBron.
Kind of power. He's not listening to what Blatt says, and if he's not going to listen, then the players aren't going to listen.
Should he be worried about his job?
ESPN might have made Blatt miss those days in the EuroLeague.
I don't know. Blatt says he faced some real danger on the court.
I've been hit in the head by a few thrown objects in my day while you're in the midst of coaching.
Jake Morton, Blatt's former player, remembers one of those times.
It happened in Europe as the first half ended.
And the buzzer sounds, and people just beeline for the locker room. Just like a total full sprint. I mean, Dave has a suit on. I mean, he has shoes. Full sprint. That guy's just running. I'm like, God, this is really a lot of intensity. And I'm kind of going at a half jog.
That's when Morton felt a sting on his back. He didn't know it then, but he was experiencing a European tradition.
They take their lighter. They light coins. They light it. They get it hot. And they throw it at you. And, you know, so I got hit with like this hot coin. I don't think there's anywhere in the United States or college or the NBA where, you know, you got to run off the court because someone's going to light a coin and throw it at you.
Speaking of heating up.
Really, Doug?
Sorry. After their early struggles, the Cavs started playing better.
And at least during the playoffs, LeBron has been saying the right things about his coach.
You be around someone, you know, pretty much for 8 months straight, you're going to automatically get to know him better, and the relationship is going to continue to get better. So we need to stay on the same page. We're always on the same page, and, you know, for the better of the team.
And as you might have noticed, Martin, and I was there, there's not a lot of enthusiasm there.
Well, he's our captain.
In Blatt's first ever NBA playoff series, the Cavs completed a sweep of the Boston Celtics.
Game 4 last weekend left Cleveland's Kevin Love with a serious shoulder injury.
And J.R. Smith with a 2-game suspension. David Blatt's NBA dream will last at least another series.
But when the Cavs hired him in June, Blatt, like most lifelong NBA fans, was dreaming of going much further.
I never for a moment lost the hope that I would come full circle and make my way back to be part of something that was so much a part of me.
Blatt thanked the people of Cleveland for giving him this opportunity.
And I know that I'm going to pay them back with interest.
Martin, do you think that interest will be paid in shekels, rubles, American dollars, maybe euros?
Doug, I think he's talking about championship rings.
Okay.
For Only a Game, I'm Martin Kessler.
And I'm Doug Tribou.
Sports entertain us, otherwise we'd pay no attention to the numbers of wins, losses, hits, shots, and rebounds generated each day. We can analyze and compare the numbers with confidence because of the orderly nature of the little worlds in which they are generated. But the numbers in the business of professional sports reflect one extreme of the spectrum of numbers, which is anything but orderly. According to Forbes, last year LeBron James made $53 million for endorsing, among other things, the fast food and soft drinks upon which many of his young fans subsist. According to ESPN's Kevin Van Valkenburg, state lottery tickets funded a huge chunk of the construction of that ballpark in which the Orioles and White Sox played their lonely game on Wednesday, and some studies have shown that those tickets were purchased by Baltimore's have-nots. But sports entertain us. They are a diversion, and that's a good thing, I guess, because there's a lot from which we prefer to be diverted. This weekend's fight between Manny Pacquiao and Floyd Mayweather is not the first to be labeled the fight of the century. It's about the 232nd, but it might be the first to generate $1 billion worth of noise. That's when you factor in the expected $300 million to be split between the fighters, the approximately $100 million to be wagered, and the hundreds of millions the casinos will realize beyond the boxing bets. But Joe Drape of the New York Times writes that boxing aficionados are sad. Joe, how could that possibly be?
Well, it's a one-punch fight for the industry right here. $1 billion sounds like a lot, and it is a lot, but it's about 12 guys who are going to whack that up. You know, the two fighters are going to take a bunch of it. The promoters are going to take a bunch of it. The town of Vegas is going to take a bunch of it. But really, it gives no bounce to the sport of boxing. It'll go another year, 5 years, 6 years without penetrating the mainstream consciousness. I mean, when was the last time you thought about a boxing match?
I'm going to mention Muhammad Ali and date myself in answer to that question.
And that's the problem, Bill. Boxing has sort of faded into the woodwork. There's been no heavyweight champion that we could latch on to. The glory days of Hagler, Hearns, Sugar Ray, De La Hoya, those have passed us by. Vladimir Klitschko is the heavyweight champion. He has more title defenses than anybody but Joe Lewis. And he couldn't sell out Madison Square Garden last week for about, you know, that's the soul of boxing, Madison Square Garden.
This, I assume, is why you have written that the epitaph for the sport was underlined last weekend.
Yeah, I have. And, you know, what we've got is we got one big weekend, Bill, and we have no signs of life after that. So, you know, it's kind of the last hurrah for boxing.
Manny Pacquiao's promoter, Bob Arum, says boxing is too brutal for most people. He told you, quote, we can't get white middle-class kids into boxing. Is that part of the reason that boxing is struggling?
The sport's definitely struggling because the lack of interest among white middle-class Americans. It's become a sport that's not accessible to them anymore. And, you know, Bob Arum said, I wouldn't let my kid do it. There's the brutality of it. There's the concussions. There's nobody you see in the ring who looks like you up there. And traditionally, the sport has always rallied around ethnicities, you know, the Irish fighters, the Hispanic fighters, the African-American fighters. So there's really no self-identifying up there. That has moved the white middle class, the former fight fans, they've moved to wrestling and mixed martial arts because, you know, it's a little more snazzier, wrestling scripted, but you can have a heel and you can have a hero. And you know, it's become more entertainment. And boxing, with its classic two guys standing in the middle of a ring, beating each other's brains out, just doesn't hold the entertainment value anymore.
Al Haymon, Mayweather's promoter, has founded something called the Premier Boxing Champions. What is that group's aim, and why have you labeled it a huge gamble?
Well, Al Haymon's raised $400 million from venture capital firms. He's trying to reinsert boxing into the mainstream. He's buying network time. NBC, he's got 20 dates on. Spike TV, he's got dates on CBS and the premium things. His gamble is, look, you guys air my product, but I'm going to go out there and I'll sell the advertising myself. He's gambling that NBC, Fox, somebody's going to want to buy it and pay him rights for it. But right now, boxing isn't in vogue enough to command anything as far as rights fees. So he's trying to build the market. And then the longer play after that is, of these 4 years, of these nights of fighting, of these series, that you're developing the next Mayweather and Pacquiao, and you can then move back into the pay-per-view and have another billion-dollar weekend in 2, 3, 4 years.
It doesn't sound to me as if you're particularly optimistic about boxing's future.
Well, I'm not particularly optimistic, Bill. I mean, look, there's so many entertainment options out there. And this is a sport that saw its heyday in the 30s, 40s, 50s. I don't think anybody feels good about watching two guys possibly do fatal damage to each other, long-lasting damage. You've really got an audience of 18 on up who really haven't grown up with boxing. You know, think about that. I mean, it's just been irrelevant for a long time.
Joe Drape is a reporter for the New York Times, and you can link to his story, Mayweather Pacquiao is an easy sell, boxing isn't, at onlyagame.org. Joe, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Bill, have a good weekend.
Shawl, as in I shawl. So it becomes Gottschall, Gottschall.
That's Jonathan Gottschall of Washington and Jefferson College in Pennsylvania. For his research into boxing and other combat sports, he decided to try mixed martial arts. He describes the experience in his new book, The Professor in the Cage. Here's Jonathan Gottschall in his own words.
I was working as an adjunct English instructor at a small liberal arts school, and I was pushing up on about 40 years old. And I'd never managed to make it on the tenure track, and I could see that I probably wasn't going to. And one day I'm at my office hours, and I happen to look out the front window of the English department, and this new business has moved in across the street, and it's called Mark Schrader's Academy of Mixed Martial Arts. It's that cage fighting stuff. And I could see the young guys in there. They're in the cage, they're dancing, they're hitting, they're tackling and rolling. And I felt this really strong sense of envy for how alive they seemed in their cage while I was kind of rotting away in my cubicle. And so I had this kind of funny thought. It was just a joke to myself. Wouldn't it be funny if I went across the street and joined them? Me, you know, a college professor, kind of chubby, never been in a fight before. And so over the next couple of weeks, or maybe even months, I sort of worked up the courage to cross that street, go get in some fights. So one of the questions I wanted to ask is, why are we attracted to fights? I'd watch fighting on TV, and I'd think to myself, you know, I'm a peace-loving person, I'm civilized, I'm apparently not a sociopath, and yet here I am watching this.
Oh, big elbow! He's got to be careful for the arm there.
What's wrong with me, and what's wrong with so many of us who are drawn to this kind of violent entertainment?
He's going for a foot.
Ritual combat is a term from biology, and the term applies to things like, if you've ever seen a nature video of a couple of elephant seals clashing in the surf or a couple of rams squaring off on the hillside, that's ritual combat. It's a way animals have come up with for deciding who's stronger, fitter, tougher, without the dangers of fighting it out to the death. And I argue that the same is true of people, only more so. People are complicated animals, cultured animals, but we're animals still. And we have all these different varieties of ritual combat, everything from pistols at dawn to deadly duels to verbal duels to play fights of boys to sports. And a lot of these contests will kind of seem silly from the outside or sometimes even kind of pathetic, but they serve an important purpose. They help people thrash out their hierarchies, settle their differences in ways that fall short of all-out violence. In sports, you can fight and fight it out hard, but you walk away friends at the end. I fought a guy named Justin McCloskey. He was a 24-year-old jiu-jitsu specialist. I was almost 40 at the time. I wanted to fight on the ground. And when you want to have a ground fight, one of the ways you can get it to the ground is you can wait for the other guy to throw a strike. And there's always this little spasm, this little twitch in his muscles right before he throws that strike. And that's when you shoot in for your takedown. And I timed it just perfectly. He threw a kick. It thwacked hard into my ribs. And at that very moment, I tackled him, grabbed the back of his knees, and drove him to the canvas. And it was loud, and it was hard, and it was kind of violent. And it felt really good. The first time I got punched really hard in the face, you get it right away. You understand that what you're involved in is, in large part, a brain damage contest. Because it doesn't really hurt your face. It hurts your brain. You can feel your brain sort of rattling around. The pain erupts inside the brain. But when you're in the cage and you're taking those punches, you really understand how much is at stake for the fighters. I was having an argument with my friend Nobu, who's a chemistry professor, and he's a second degree black belt. He'd been training in martial arts for almost 30 years, and I've been training in cage fighting for about a year. And we wanted to do sort of a scientific experiment. And yes, we were kind of tipsy at this point because we were at a faculty party. He'd been wondering, can I really win a fight? Does my karate training actually work? As a scientist, he was interested in actually running the experiment. And the only way to experiment in this area is to actually kind of have the fight. So we square off in the grass. We lean our drinks up against the house. We take off our shoes and our socks. We put our phones and our wallets into our shoes. And we're doing this test. And time and again, I put him on the ground and basically forced him to submit through some sort of choke or joint lock. It was kind of fascinating for both of us, I think, because he knew that his martial arts worked, and yet all of his skills, all of his trainings were neutralized, and not by some martial arts grandmaster, but by a newbie like me. I won. I won big, but I felt tremendous guilt about it, laying awake deep into the night, sort of upbraiding myself. I felt like a bully. I felt like I'd bullied my friend out of this belief that was really central to his identity, that he was a man who knew how to fight. I never slew Goliath, Never once. I never beat a decent cage fighter. But I was able to knock around a slightly built chemistry professor pretty well. I continued training for more than 2 years and only gave it up when my body gave out entirely, when I just couldn't do it anymore. There's a tremendously high cost to cage fighting, an obvious cost. I paid a high physical cost to it, to my body. I may have done lasting damage to myself physically. And who knows, maybe I did lasting damage to my brain. Fighting is really, really scary. The pain of it is really, really intense. The anxiety of it is really, really overwhelming. But at the same time, the high of competing in a physical fight is something that's sort of unmatchable. And when I left that gym, you know, for the last time, I left feeling very sad, like this great romance in my life was over and I was too old and too brittle to ever recapture it.
Jonathan Gottschall is the author of The Professor in the Cage, Why Men Fight and Why We Like to Watch. The IOC calls it beach volleyball. The NCAA calls it sand volleyball. Whatever its name, the sport has recently enjoyed rapid growth. 8 teams are in Alabama this weekend for the 4th and final American Volleyball Coaches Association Sand Volleyball National Championships. The NCAA will take over the event next year, which will further raise the profile of an already budding sport. From Boise, Idaho, Scott Graff reports.
This is a story about a sport that, pardon the pun, has seen its popularity spike ever since August 2004. The Olympics were in Athens, and here in the U.S., Americans were watching a young athletic duo from California dominate their beach volleyball competition.
Match point. It's coming over, and Walsh puts it away! The Americans have won the gold medal!
Misty May Traynor and Kerry Walsh repeated in 2008 in Beijing. 4 years later, they won gold again in London before retirement ended their run. With every win, the sport's profile grew.
What they did to put the sport of beach volleyball on the map is legendary and I think will never be repeated.
Kathy DeBoer is the executive director of the American Volleyball Coaches Association.
You have a whole generation of little girls growing up watching beach volleyball as an Olympic sport. Very, very popular sport, played at a very, very high level.
Data from the Sports and Fitness Industry Association show huge growth in the number of young people playing sand volleyball during those gold medal runs. Between 2007 and 2013, sand volleyball added 1.4 million participants. Among girls ages 6 to 24, participation jumped by 45%. Today, that popularity is showing up on college campuses in places like Los Angeles, Tallahassee, and Honolulu, and in places like Boise. Here, teams from Boise State, Oregon, and Arizona play round-robin matches in cloudy and cool weather. For Boise State junior Taylor Murphy and her teammates, this is their first ever home match.
My freshman year, I would have never thought that I would be playing sand the last 2 years I was in college. I hadn't even really watched a whole lot of sand besides Olympics, and so when Sean told us, yeah, we're getting a sand program, it was completely different because I had no idea what other teams had sand programs. And they're just, from last year to this year, there's so many teams that have been added.
Sean is Murphy's head coach, Sean Garris, and he's the person most responsible for convincing administrators at a school known for its football and blue turf that sand volleyball made sense. Garris is the school's indoor volleyball coach and sold the idea as a way to improve that program.
What is it worth to get 5 more weeks of a competitive season to any sport? You know, what would football do for 5 more weeks of training? What would basketball do for 5 more weeks? Well, sand volleyball offered us an opportunity to add a sport, but use the same athletes, use the same coaching staff. For a very, very minimal budget, we could get 5 more weeks of training that's going to make us a better program overall.
In 2013, Boise State became the first school in the Intermountain West and Northwest to announce it was adding a sand volleyball program. Garris says last fall's indoor volleyball campaign was the school's best in 2 decades, and he thinks the sand volleyball schedule last spring was one reason why. Sophomore Lainey Hayes says the sand game has improved her skills.
Yeah, and like she said, I'm the main blocker, so I think blocking out here in the sand and really
it's more of a strategic game, I guess, and it's harder to jump. So when I get back to the indoor game, I'll be jumping higher. I'll be reading people better because it's a lot more shots out here. So it definitely helps indoor game when there's overlap.
In Tucson, the University of Arizona last year made sand volleyball its first new sport in 16 years. Now the program is ranked in the top 10, and head coach Steve Walker is taking calls from other schools, some in cold weather states, who are also interested in adding sand volleyball.
Well, I think the Midwest programs want to add. I really do. You know, I've fielded inquiries from a number of Big Ten schools on a facility and how to add. You know, Nebraska has an underground facility. I could see this picking up 5 to 10 schools annually, and I don't see it slowing down anytime soon.
When the NCAA begins to manage the sport next year, more than 50 schools will offer sand volleyball. It's the fastest sport to go from the NCAA's emerging sport list to obtaining championship status. One big reason for that is affordability. In South Carolina, the College of Charleston spent just $40,000 to add sand volleyball. Factor in Title IX gender equity benefits, and many schools find the sport too attractive to pass up. That growth is exciting for Kathy DeBoer, the head of the Sports Coaches Association, but she admits it also has her a little worried. She says if sand volleyball grows too quickly, it risks thinning out the talent pool in the indoor game, and volleyball, she says, could cannibalize itself. But overall, DeBoer is excited about the future of sand. When asked if it will ever be able to compete with higher-profile spring sports like college softball, DeBoer doesn't hesitate.
I think it's going to happen. I think it's not only possible, I think it's destiny.
This weekend's tournament is being held in Gulf Shores, Alabama. The NCAA will decide this fall where it will host next year's championship. For Only a Game, I'm Scott Graff in Boise.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a real Hall of Fame for pretend athletes. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
I should be in that charter class.
Keep looking and listening, and perhaps you'll make the cut. I don't know. Proving that he has learned from past mistakes, Jameis Winston celebrated his selection as the number one pick in the NFL draft by Instagramming a photo of himself in front of a large serving of crab legs. So you think the Tampa Bay Buccaneers want a do-over?
Well, I suppose from his standpoint, it's better than posing in an orange jumpsuit.
Excellent point.
But there was a lot of smoke being blown around, but he was the obvious pick for Tampa.
Winston and second overall pick Marcus Mariota both declined to travel to Chicago to be part of the NFL's draft day extravaganza. Depending on whom you listen to, that's either a sign of the apocalypse or it's a charming decision by two young men who just wanted to celebrate the big day with their families. What's your take?
Well, it's a thoroughgoing insult to the city of Chicago, number one. I don't know. I think the one thing I do know is that there will be a rule about this passed sometime before next year's draft.
On the eve of the draft, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell spoke about the league's determination to, quote, provide players with the resources to be the kind of role models we want. Do you suppose that's why Jameis Winston wasn't there?
I don't have any idea what that means. They already do this rookie camp thing and where everybody goes in there and they give them 5 or 10 days worth of lectures on the theme, don't commit crimes. And it hasn't been working out very well, so...
As we have mentioned, the draft was held in Chicago this year. Is that why it had more production, more bells, more whistles, things of that nature?
Well, not to further the insult to the city of Chicago, but it's hard to get more bells and more whistles than you get in Times Square, which is generally where the draft was. I think it's a pretty good idea because apparently they're going to move it around to a bunch of different cities. I can hardly wait till it's in Jacksonville.
Well, they are going to move it around to a bunch of different cities, and this time around it cost, I am told, between $3 and $4 million. I suppose next year's bidder better be ready to spend $4 to $5 million.
Well, somehow I figure Jerry Jones is going to get in on this sooner or later.
Nearly lost in the excitement of the NFL draft was an announcement on Tuesday that the league is voluntarily giving up tax-exempt status, quote, to eliminate distraction. Or was it to eliminate the requirement that they tell the world how much they pay Roger Goodell every year?
That's exactly why they did it. This is about not wanting to open their books because there are a number of very good reasons why they don't want to open their books.
On Wednesday, the Baltimore Orioles played a game in an empty ballpark, Charlie. Was this an appropriate response to the protests and the violence that erupted in Baltimore after the death of Freddie Gray?
I've gone back and forth on that. I think it was the safest option they had. The ultimate safest option they would have would have been to move the game out, which they did for the subsequent games. But I once attended a basketball game during a measles outbreak between Boston University and Northeastern, where there were no fans. It is very strange.
Yeah. Well, Tim Kirchen let us in on how strange it was a little earlier in the program, and very bizarre indeed.
Apparently, baseball is a lot noisier than you think it is.
One editorial suggested that the fans should have been allowed into the stands to give Baltimore the chance to begin to rise above the, quote, embarrassment caused by TV coverage of the unrest. That editorial was written by a TV news executive. I think I'll just step out of the way and allow you to respond to that.
Yeah, this is, I think this guy's concerns are way down the list, considering that they just indicted six policemen on Friday.
Good point. Here's another baseball headline. MLB showing notable drop in game time will relax pace of play fines. That's kind of like a doctor saying the treatment is working so well, we're going to discontinue it. Right?
What is that all about?
I don't know.
I mean, just when you think that baseball is finally getting it, they do something like this. The rules are working, so naturally we have to relax them. I mean, it's May, for God's sakes. They've only been playing under these rules for a month.
Yeah, I know. When it gets hot, those games are going to slow down. There's no question about it. In the run-up to the fight of the century, Charlie Floyd Mayweather said, and I'm quoting now, "No one can brainwash me to believe that Sugar Ray Robinson and Muhammad Ali were better than me." That called for a response from none other than...
Muhammad Ali's Twitter account.
Yeah.
He's still the greatest, and Floyd Mayweather is still something of a mouthy non-entity on this regard.
Finally, I guess it's no shock that a high court judge in the UK has ruled that bridge players should be, quote, ranked alongside sportsmen of the highest order.
Sports!
But I was a little surprised by Mr. Justice Mostyn's rationale.
Yes, he said that a brain is a muscle and therefore has to be exercised. I mean, of course, by this standard, nuclear physics is a sport.
Next week, Charlie on nuclear physics. You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland. And, of course, he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Perhaps you are a sports fan and a fan of fiction, too. If so, there is a Hall of Fame entirely for you. This hall includes Crash Davis, also Rocky and Roy Hobbs. The Hanson brothers may soon join, though they were sort of slobs. For a preview of who might actually be inducted next into the 2015 Fictitious Athlete Hall of Fame, we'll turn to the man who came up with the idea for that institution, Kirk Buckner. Welcome to Only a Game.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
There are many halls of fame dedicated to the enshrinement of actual athletes who've done actual athletic things. Why is there a need for a Hall of Fame for fictitious athletes?
That's probably not just an inspiration I came one day.
I think we're off to a terrific start. Forgive me if I have missed an important bit of pop culture. It wouldn't be the first time. But what exactly were the athletic contributions of Al Bundy and Homer Simpson?
Al Bundy scored 4 touchdowns in a high school football game and never let anyone forget it.
Mm-hmm.
Homer Simpson had multiple occasions with athletics. He represented the United States in mixed curling. He was a little league coach. He was also the star of his company's softball team.
I want to give our listeners a sense of why I think one guy on your list should be a shoe-in. Just listen to this for a minute.
We thank you so much for this bountiful harvest of Domino's, KFC, and the always delicious Taco Bell. I just want to take time to say thank you for my family, my two beautiful, beautiful, handsome, striking sons, Walker and Texas Ranger.
That, of course, is the famed fictional race car driver, Ricky Bobby from Talladega Nights. You like his chances?
He was a semifinalist last year. He's a semifinalist again this year with a higher percentage of the vote. Yeah, I do.
Let's have a little musical interlude as a clue to the identity of another candidate.
Uh-oh.
Making your way in the world today takes everything you've got.
Sam Mayday Malone is a semifinalist, Kirk.
Yes.
By the time we meet him in Cheers, Malone is long retired. We haven't seen him pitch. We have to rely on guys like Norman Cliffey for tales of Malone's talent. Maybe that should be a concern.
Absolutely it is. And I think what really doesn't help Cheers, and specifically that character, I'm going to take it that you're a Cheers fan.
Well, I used to be. Wasn't everybody?
I would think so. It was a great show back in the day. But for whatever reason, Cheers just isn't on reruns that much anymore. So I think that hurts him more than anything.
Roy Tin Cup McAvoy, played by Kevin Costner in the movie Tin Cup, is eligible. But wait a minute, another Costner character, Crash Davis, is already in the hall. Is there any limit on number of characters played by the same actor who can be enshrined?
Not at all. Kevin Costner is my patron saint of fictional characters in athletics. Even when with that movie, Draft Day, I completely buy him as a general manager, even though he made a trade that made absolutely no sense.
Now, I'm not surprised that Rocky Balboa was in the first class of inductees. Likewise, the aforementioned Crash Davis and Roy Hobbs as well. Did you hear from either Sylvester Stallone, Kevin Costner, or Robert Redford about the characters they played achieving immortality?
No, but I got politely turned down by Carl Weathers, whose agent informed me that he no longer wants to discuss being Apollo Creed anymore.
He was Apollo Creed in four Rocky movies, right?
Apollo Creed in four Rocky movies, yeah. Chubbs Peterson and Happy Gilmore, former football player. I mean, like it or not, Mr. Weathers, you're Apollo Creed, and that's not the worst thing to be.
Finally, Kirk, is there an actual hall? I mean, is there somewhere that I would be able to go to see the likenesses of the honorees, plaques perhaps, or at least publicity stills?
Well, since this is a fictitious hall celebrating fictitious athletes, I decided it's a fictitious hall too. Long story short, I don't have the funds yet, but I like my first answer a little bit better. I don't know.
Well, you just wait until people hear about this on Only a Game and the money starts rolling in, my friend.
I will cut you in on that, sir.
Kirk Buckner is the owner and the operator of the Fictitious Athlete Hall of Fame. You can vote for your favorite fictitious athlete by going to notinthehalloffame.com. The finalist will be announced on August 15th, 2015. Kirk, thank you very much. You've been a good sport with this. I appreciate you joining me.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to the sound of juggler Michael Motion as he rhythmically bounces three balls inside a large triangle. Like much of the new feature documentary Bounce, this sequence is pure fun, but the film's purpose is expressed in its subtitle, How the Ball Taught the World to Play. Bounce was based on a book by John Fox titled The Ball, Discovering the Object of the Game. He's also the film's co-producer. John, welcome to Only a Game.
Great to be here, Bill.
Also joining me in the studio is the documentary's director, Jerome Telia. Great to have you here.
Thank you.
John, the film includes dazzling footage of chimps playing with a ball, kids in Brazil kicking around a ball that's been made of scraps of plastic and cloth and bound up with twine, even dolphins learning to dribble a soccer ball underwater. What can animals and children teach us about how the ball taught us to play?
Play precedes human culture. As we say in the film, we didn't invent play, we just added to it. And those sequences show that dolphins and chimpanzees not only play, but they play with objects, including balls, with the same degree of delight. And what we try to get at is why. A lot of it is the cognitive development, the way it's a conveyor of social dynamic, and ultimately also just an expression of joy.
Jerome, give us a sense of where you went to collect the elements necessary to tell the story of Bounce.
It might be quicker to give you a sense of where we didn't go. We went so many places. We really looked at this concept of the ball and how it teaches us to play, how it inspires us to play. We didn't want history or geography to be any kind of an impediment, so we were really open to going anywhere and filming just about anything to get at sort of the core ideas of the film. So that led us to the Democratic Republic of Congo. It led us to India, look at cricket there, film kids playing marbles there as well. Bonobos playing with balls, also in Congo. We went to, in the end, to about 10 different countries and, you know, went as far back as a couple million years in history and trying to answer this question.
John, you say in the film, which you co-wrote, the ball game is a microcosm of our lives. When we win, we thank God. When we lose, we curse the universe. It's the place where we can act out the drama of human existence. Can you elaborate a little on that idea?
As far back as we can remember, the ball games we played were tied to our belief in the universe. So the ancient Maya, for example, believed that the ball was like the sun and the moon moving in the sky. Mm-hmm. And by playing the ball game, they were perpetuating the universe. There's something elemental about that I think is still with us today, where games that we play and watch are more than just what's happening in the game. There's always other dynamics at work, whether it's politics, whether it's race, gender. Those are the things that are being negotiated in the act of playing. So in that way, it does kind of represent this microcosm of who we are as a society.
There's a paradox at the core of all ball games. The fact that the rules are arbitrary, that it's only a game, and that at the same time we take it incredibly seriously.
One of my favorite moments in the film features a sociologist named David Goldblatt. He's been on the program before. He's the author of several excellent books involving soccer. Here he is talking about the great leap forward that occurred when the people of South America discovered how to incorporate the sap from the rubber tree into their ball-making process.
Imagine you've spent millennia as humanity kicking pebbles and skulls, and something bounces. Oh, my God.
Beyond the sheer exhilaration of a bouncing ball, the rubberized spheroid was an important historical development as well, right?
It absolutely was. As David points out earlier, the genius of Mesoamerican culture was to figure out not only how to use rubber to make something, but how to vulcanize it. That process of discovering it really brings together a number of elements that define not only the game, but its symbolic relationship to nature and to culture and to sort of human intervention. It's really at the core of that game.
Bounces in a different direction at the end. Among the commentators who feel that play will save us from the world's problems is editor and political writer Lewis H. Lapham.
We will come up with some idea to rescue us. That's where it'll come out of. It'll come out of the realm of play.
John, as the film demonstrates, humans have played even as they've created pollution, overpopulation, global warming, and so on. If it was going to save us, wouldn't play have done so already?
I mean, I think we've been creating problems and solving problems all at once over thousands of years. I don't think there's any one single solution that's facing us. However, I think human history is one of free play and not so highly regimented and certainly not commercialized. And so I think part of the point of the film in the end is to say, you know, there's a lot involved in free play that's essential to being human and essential to understanding and solving the complex world that we live in.
It's not to say that it's a panacea and that we can solve all of our problems this way. It's more sort of a wake-up call to say that, you know, if we sort of listen to our biology rather than sort of the most recent cultural innovations, that maybe we can get at the solutions to these problems a little bit differently.
Jerome Telia co-wrote Bounce. He directed it as well. Jerome, thank you very much for coming in today.
Thanks so much for having us.
And John Fox is the co-writer and co-producer of Bounce, How the Ball Taught the World to Play. John, pleasure to see you here.
Thanks, Bill. It's a lot of fun.
For a schedule of Bounce screenings, please bounce on over to bouncethemovie.com. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabue. Our assistant producer is Martin Kessler. Our technical director is James Trout. And our intern is Keely Flanagan. We had help this week from Michael Garth and Eric Larrabee. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word comes from the New York Times' Joe Drake, who told me he's in Kentucky this weekend.
Well, we got the 141st running of the Kentucky Derby, and since I'm in charge of all dead sports, I had to be here.
Joe's upcoming columns on bandy wicket, hoop rolling, and the late lamented belt sander racing should be great. I'm Bill Littlefield. I'll be back next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.